Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live, April 13, 2008, here at WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone we've been waiting for a long time to get on the program. We're delighted to have him join us. He is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, former chief economist for the World Bank, one of the most well-known and acclaimed political economists of our era. Our guest will be Joseph E. Stiglitz. And Professor Stiglitz will be discussing the new book he co-authored on the cost of the war in Iraq, called The $3 Trillion War. We'll be talking with Joe Stiglitz for the next hour, so please sit back and relax and enjoy the show. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Everybody wants faster, cheaper internet. But the phone and cable companies that dominate 99% of residential internet access often refuse to make public where they actually offer service or what speeds are really available. That's why Drew Clark founded BroadbandCensus.com.
When you go to broadbandcensus.com and you type in your zip code, you'll see a number about how many providers the FCC says reach your zip code. And that's not a complete list because the FCC very much overcounts carriers.
Once you put in your information about your broadband provider, you can test your broadband speed.
You can take our speed test and find out whether or not the carriers are living up to the promises they're making in terms of the speeds for the internet that they claim to sell you.
A longtime journalist on the telecommunications beat, Clark has been interested in broadband for many years. He's been trying to collect broadband data, but the providers don't want the public and their competitors or federal regulators to know exactly where their customers are or are not.
I've been trying to get this data out of the Federal Communications Commission very actively, and I've filed Freedom of Information Act requests, and when those weren't responded to, actually had to bring a lawsuit against the FCC, and even so, they still haven't provided the data about the names of the providers. So this BroadbandCensus.com is an effort to go around them.
Clark says there's a lot of skepticism out there about the numbers and the statistics that the FCC has been collecting. The goal of the broadband census is to take what he calls a crowdsourcing approach to gathering broadband data that will help consumers choose broadband providers and pressure lawmakers for better broadband service.
And I sit down on the couch with my four-year-old daughter who loves Google Earth, and we look at different parts of the globe. We spin the Earth around. I mean, this is what broadband enables. But I'm always being constrained by the capacity of my broadband provider. And I think that while competition can get us part of the way there, we're not able to have a market for competition if people, consumers like me and you, don't have access to data about whether they're providing what they claim they're providing.
To take the broadband census and find out about your broadband speeds, go to broadbandcensus.com.
Hello, I'm Community Television.
And I'm corporate media. The channels I own serve as my personal mouthpiece. I tell you what I've told you you want to know.
Wow, that sounds really great for you.
Community television long has been an avenue for free expression and vital local information. But in recent years, public, educational, and government public channels have been under assault by big cable and phone companies. They've pushed legislation through 17 states that seriously threaten PEG channels. Community Television of Santa Cruz decided to take a creative and entertaining approach to inform their neighbors about the importance of supporting their TV station. Executive Director John Patterson says that Community TV offers an alternative to mainstream media for viewers and a lot more for those who want to be involved in making their own media.
Community Television provides a way for people to, you know, get some training and learn how to communicate. Because anybody can shoot something and just throw it up on a website, but being able to craft something to better express what you're trying to express is something that we can provide through training and that YouTube doesn't do that.
To spread the word, the station produced a parody of popular Apple computer commercials.
I carry local programming by local people and provide a forum for diverse community dialogues that anyone can participate in.
Really local, huh? Well, I own stations all over the country, so my programming is designed to be generic and appealing to the majority. It keeps my corporate advertisers happy.
I connect people to their communities by televising local government meetings and community events, things that would otherwise never be shown on TV.
Huh. Well, I could never do that. But hey, everything I show is carefully screened through focus groups gathered from NASCAR races and Walmart parking lots. I suppose you let just about anybody on TV.
That's right, we do. Community television makes production facilities and training available to every member of the community, who can then produce their own programming and have it televised free of charge.
Well, that sounds terribly unprofitable.
Oh, corporate media. It's not always about money.
See the clip for yourself at communitytv.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL, AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have, as a guest on the show, someone I've been eager to have, whose work I've been reading for years, and whose recent book, which he's co-authored with Linda J. Bilmes, is a book I wish everyone in the audience had a chance to read and share with their friends and family. It's called The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, and our guest, the co-author, is Joseph Stiglitz, former chair of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, the chief economist during that period of the World Bank, the 2001 Nobel Prize winner in economics, currently a professor of economics and author of numerous books, which really make political economy accessible to the public without watering down the quality of the analysis. It's an honor to welcome to the show Joseph Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
Well, I really, one of the pleasures of doing my program every week is I have an opportunity to read books like this that I might not otherwise be able to make the time to read. This book was truly a pleasure for me to read.
Thank you.
I meant what I said earlier. And I think because we're going to talk a little bit about the accounting that went into it that you and Professor Bilmes did to come up with the cost of the war, I want to make clear at the outset, this is not a book just that's full of dry accounting. It includes within it a very strong critique of the initial war goals, a critique of the occupation itself, an argument, I thought, in maybe the finest chapter in the book, for the immediate withdrawal of the troops, as well as a striking critique, at times heartbreaking, of the way our soldiers and veterans are being treated currently, either in Iraq or when they return home. And there's a lot more to the book than that. So I want to make that clear, because I know that for a while I do want to go through the accounting, but this is a much richer book than I think the title might suggest.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's always, you know, when you write a book like that, you put in a lot of work into these other chapters, including that chapter on the exit strategy. And I really do appreciate that you appreciated that.
Yeah, and, you know, first of all, let's start, Professor Stiglitz, at the top. Why did you write this book? What was your motivation? And Professor Bilmes as well.
Well, it actually began several years ago for the annual American Economic Association meetings. You know, we spend a lot of money on defense, but there's very little solid analytic work, analysis of those defense expenditures. I had the conjecture that the numbers that they were putting out did not really adequately represent the true cost to our society of this war. So it began as an exploration of exactly what those true costs were. But then as we got into the research, we discovered how difficult it was to get the numbers out of the government. It became also an exercise, you might say, in investigative reporting.
And, you know, that's one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading the book was, you know, where's our news media been on covering this story? Why, you know, for all the time that our pundits spend discussing breaking down participles and quotes out of context of presidential candidates, where are the people digging in to come up with what really is a work of investigative journalism?
That's right. I mean, just take one example. We did, in calculating the cost of the war, one of the important ingredients, obviously, is the number of people who've been injured. There have been a huge number of injuries in this war. But what we discovered in our research was that the number that the media often quotes, the number that the Department of Defense puts out on their website, is about half of the true number. We were working with the veterans groups, used the Freedom of Information Act, and discovered that unlike the case of fatalities, where they'll report both combatant and non-combatant fatalities, they were only reporting the combatant accidents. So if a helicopter crashed at night because it couldn't fly during the day because of the hostilities, that was treated as a non-combatant injury and wouldn't show up in the injury statistics that were quoted over and over again.
Yeah, that is one of the features of the book. I appreciate it, too. You went, I think, it's not just about the economic cost. It also goes into the human cost of life and casualty, and you go through a lot of these categories and shed light on the extent of the human cost, both for Americans and especially, I must say, for Iraqis, of this war. Before we go into the figure of $3 trillion, how you set it, and some of the ways you went about your research, I do want to ask you one question. You make it very clear at the beginning of the book that you and Professor Wilms both opposed the invasion of Iraq before it took place. How did you feel about the war in Afghanistan?
Well, I had ambivalent feelings. The question, 9/11 was a very big traumatic event for the United States, and clearly there can't be refuge for people who are attacking the United States. So doing something about that seemed an imperative. I think personalizing it in Bin Laden was a mistake, and the fact that 7 years later we still haven't caught him. It typifies the dangers of that kind of personalization of the struggle. But clearly, one of the concerns that we raise is this notion that there is an opportunity cost. Money spent in one place is money that could have been spent in another. And the same thing about security. Afghanistan was related to 9/11, and while we were focusing on Iraq that had nothing to do with 9/11, things went very badly in Afghanistan where there was a connection.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Joseph Stiglitz, the co-author with Linda J. Bilmes of the brand new book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. We'll be talking about the book this hour here on Media Matters. Professor Stiglitz, of course, a Nobel Prize winner in economics who has written widely for popular audiences and been on the radio speaking as an expert widely for popular audiences in economic issues. So callers are welcome to take advantage of his presence today at 333-9455 or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. The title of the book, Professor Stiglitz, The $3 Trillion War, obviously sets what you see as the figure for the cost of the war. And I'd like you to talk about, some of the, how you went about coming up with that figure. And I know what you go in great detail in the book, and obviously I don't want you to repeat all that here, but maybe to sum up some of the key criteria you used and issues you dealt with to reach that figure.
Sure. And before that, I should probably mention that actually, you can't estimate something like that with precision. And because we knew we were open about criticizing the war, we wanted to err on the conservative side. We didn't want to have a lot of quibbles, so that our we actually think the war will cost the cost of the economy is far greater than $3 trillion, and we give a range of $3 to $5 trillion.
And you're talking to make clear too. This is just the cost of the United States.
The cost of the United States.
So if the cost of the rest of the world, including Iraq, probably combined, will be even greater than what it is in the United States.
Exactly, and these are only the kind of costs that can be quantified with some degree of precision. There are lots of other costs that can't be quantified. The loss of America's credibility in the world, our stature, our ability to exercise leadership on issues like human rights. All of these are very important costs, but we can't quantify them, so they're not included in that dollar sum. So the way we went about doing this is just a matter of arithmetic. You begin with the amounts that they own up to, that they say the $600 billion that we've already spent, and then you look at, are there costs, military costs, that are hidden elsewhere? And we know the answer to that is yes. Expenditures for the Defense Department, not including Afghanistan and Iraq, have gone up cumulatively $500 billion since the war began, and some of that is disguising, clearly disguising Iraq war, you know, or at least a consequence of the Iraq war. For instance, it's much more expensive to recruit people to the armed forces, whether they're serving in Iraq or not. So we attribute about a quarter of that $500 billion increase to the war. Then there are the costs that we're going to be incurring in the future, and these are really the most serious additions on the budgetary side. Those come into basically three categories. The first is the fact the war is still going on. And we look then at various Department of Defense scenarios, various scenarios that the Congressional Budget Office used, from a very conservative one to a more moderate one, all of which assume that we are out of there by 2017. So they're not the 100-year scenarios that some people have been talking about. These are all, you might say, on the conservative side of relatively moderate paces of disengagement. And then there are the costs of resetting the military and demobilization. You know, this war has been very hard on the military. We've been using up equipment faster than we've been replacing it and repairing it. And so we turn again to the defense experts to see how much it would cost to restore it to our pre-war strength. And finally, the biggest price tag is disability compensation and health care for the very large number of returning disabled veterans. About 40% of those returning will have some kind of disability, the average about 5 to 8. 1.65 million have already been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. In the moderate scenarios, the number will be 2 million or more. So we're talking about a lot of people returning with disabilities. Just to put it in context, that very, very short war, the first Gulf War, you know, sometimes called a 100-hour war, lasted a month. We are paying, just in disability compensation, for that very short war, $4.3 billion a year.
Wow.
And so you could imagine then what a five-year war, where we know that every time troops get redeployed, and many of them now have been 2, 3, 4 redeployments. It really stresses, and the likelihood of serious problems, including mental health problems, show up. So we already know about 52,000 have come back diagnosed with PTSD, 100,000 with some form of mental health problem.
No, PTSD, for the sake of our listeners not familiar with that term,
is post-traumatic stress syndrome. This was the you might call it signature injury problem from Vietnam War, and you know, they would come back. It's a large number of homelessness in the United States, which disproportionately related to the Vietnamese Vietnam returning veterans. Men and women are not made to go through that kind of stress, and at least a lot of them can't take it. And these people have been put under enormous stress, and inevitably there is a lot of them wind up with long-term disabilities. About a third of the Vietnam War experience was about a third of them were unemployable with PTSD in the end. So those are among the kinds of budgetary expenditures. Just the veterans' expenditures themselves are an unfunded entitlement that will amount to probably in excess of $600 billion. So, you know, that's a lot of money. So that by itself is doubling what we've already spent. Then in addition to that, there's the interest cost. You know, this is the first war in America's history that's been bought on the credit card. We had a deficit when we went to war. In every other war, there's been a discussion of how do we share the burden? You're sending off our young men and women to fight for us, to make sacrifices. There's a sense there ought to be shared sacrifice. Those who can't fight share in that sacrifice by paying taxes. What did we do this time? We gave a tax cut for upper-income Americans. So that means, because we borrowed everything, we have to pay interest, and we have to pay interest on the interest. And it's like buying a car on credit. The sticker price might be $20,000, but by the time if you buy it totally on credit, you'll be paying $40,000 to the car company before you're through.
Yeah, one of the issues that emerged really quickly in your book that you talked about was the accounting practices that are used in the budget that sort of mask or certainly make very difficult to understand what the actual costs are of the war. I think at one point you and Professor Bilmes wrote that were any business to engage in this type of accounting, the Security and Exchange Commission would, you know, call them up and be prosecuting them. It would simply be unacceptable to keep your books like this.
That's right. And the reason why this is important is that it's not only that citizens ought to know what is going on, what the costs are going to be, just like shareholders ought to know what's, you know, what the costs are, and that's why the Securities and Exchange Commission takes accounting very seriously. But it's also that when you don't have good accounting frameworks, you make bad decisions. So the critical mistake in the accounting framework that is used is called cash versus accrual accounting. So a firm, for instance, that hired a worker but promises him a big pension, when the firm hires them, there is this called deferred compensation, and that liability has to be put on the books. It's something the firm owes. Well, the same thing when we have some troops fighting in Iraq and they get injured, we have a deferred liability. We have to pay health care. We have to pay disability compensation. And I mentioned that we're talking about $600 billion. And that's the kind of thing that we ought to be recognizing as we're going through our accounting. Now, where you get bad accounting leading to bad decisions is that because it doesn't show up, you wind up in what, or, you know, to use the aphorism, penny-wise, pound-foolish decisions. You try to keep down the upfront cost, but that, of course, just balloons the total cost. I mean, the example was got so much attention earlier was the failure to buy body armor. Mm-hmm. Rumsfeld said, you know, you go to war with the army that you have. Well, does anybody really believe that we could not have, the strength of the American economy could not have produced body armor if an order had been put in? Of course we could. And people were buying them for their children, those who could afford it, not the very poor, but middle-class parents were buying it for their children. But we were saving on the budget. You know, it shows you the relevance of economics. They were trying to keep the upfront cost down, even though the total cost would be increased because we'd wind up paying for the disability. And, of course, the human cost was increased enormously. And one of the other examples of investigative reporting that we found out, again, using the Freedom of Information Act, the president had said that, you know, he'd give the troops anything they needed. Well, we discovered that the commanders had asked for these MRAPs, these specially designed vehicles that are designed to resist the IEDs, these explosive devices, which caused so many of the fatalities and so many of the injuries. They requested that as early as early part of 2005. We have the document showing that was a request.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as Rumsfeld was, was Secretary of Defense, no orders were put in. It wasn't until Gates became the Secretary of Defense in 2007 that the orders were put in. Now, that means, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of people suffered unnecessary deaths and injuries because we were being penny-wise and pound-foolish.
Another issue that comes out when you're talking about the budget process is something that I think all of us hear in the news or read in the news when they discuss the Iraq War budget, but it was never, has never been really explained to me as you did in the book with Professor Bilmes, which is this use of the emergency budget to pay for the war. Could you explain why we're using this process and how it's being used improperly?
Well, you know, the emergency appropriations are supposed to be things like Hurricane Katrina. You can't anticipate those. Every year you have certain kinds of emergencies. You have an appropriation for the basic funding of the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA, but you can't anticipate something the magnitude of Hurricane Katrina. So that's what the emergency appropriation process is for. Everything else is supposed to go through a regular budgetary process where you scrutinize it. You have analysts within the administration, analysts within Congress looking at it, making sure there's no corruption, that the procurement procedures are correct. Well, so at the beginning of the war, you could understand using the emergency appropriation process. But 5 years into the war, we are still using these emergency appropriations as if, everything's a surprise. The president says we're going to have to stay the course, and still they're using the emergency appropriations.
Professor Stiglitz, were they using these emergency appropriations during World War II or Korea or Vietnam?
No, nowhere near to the same extent, because we are totally relying on these. And the reason, I think, is pretty simple. You asked why. Again, I think it was an attempt to keep from the American people what the true costs of the war were. There have been 24 separate appropriations. They're done in dribs and drabs. Before we started adding the numbers together, we would talk to some congresspeople, and they were surprised what the totals were. They'd appropriate one month and another one a few months later. And by putting out in dribs and drabs, you never came and told Congress or the American people, this is what you're spending. You're buying. When we went to war, they said it was going to cost $50 to $60 billion. Now we bought a war that's already cost us up front $600 billion. We're spending now $12 billion a month, and every 3 or 4 months we're spending what they said at the beginning the total cost of the war was.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Joseph E. Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and co-author with Linda J. Bilmes of the brand-new book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, a book that has just come out, published by Norton, available, I'm sure, wherever fine books are sold, either online or in stores themselves. Our phone number here, if you'd like to have a question for Professor Stiglitz, is 333-9455, our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone line right now. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I used you as a reference when I emailed my senator a couple of weeks ago asking them when that stimulus package was being debated to go along with what you were saying, which was money needed to be put into food stamps and unemployment. I guess it didn't do much good. But my a little bit off the subject, I guess, a larger economics question. Could you lay out for me how we can, various scenarios where we could avoid massive inflation going into the future? Because, I don't know anything about economics, but it just seems to me when we have so much debt that the value of the dollar is going down, we'll have to go down a lot more, and we're going to have a huge round of inflation. So if you could explain one way or the other how that either will happen or could be avoided, I'd appreciate it, and I'll hang up and listen off the air. Thank you.
Good questions. First, let me comment on the first part of your statement about writing to your congressman about the need for a stronger stimulus. The U.S. Is in a recession. It's a very serious problem. News keeps coming out that is very, very negative. And some people said that there are two issues in this election, the war and the economy. I think there's really one issue, and that's the war, because the war is very central to understanding what's going on in the economy. You talk about the need for stimulus. Everybody says the need for stimulus, but Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve and formerly Bush's chief economic advisor, himself said the big difference between the economic situation we're in today and in 2001 was that in 2001 we had a 2% of GDP surplus. That gave us room to maneuver. That gave us room to have a more of a stimulus package. The problem is now we have a very large deficit, partly attributable to the war. In fact, this year we're expecting a total deficit close to $500 billion, the largest deficit probably in our history. The problem is that the war, while we're spending a lot of money, doesn't stimulate the economy very much. you know, you take a money that you're spending to pay for a Naples contractor working in Iraq, it just doesn't give the boost to the economy that taking that same dollar, spending it on schools, in education, research here in the United States, let alone talk about the effects on long-run productivity.
Now, the Professor Stiglitz, if I can just interject for your sake, in the book you give a pretty nice discussion of that exact point.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's a very important point because people should understand that the weaknesses in the economy are not just an accident. Now, the other point you raise is inflation, and again, it's something that we talk about. The war has had clear inflationary impacts. The most obvious is because the war set forth the increases in the price of oil. Futures markets in 2003 saw the price of oil remaining where it was, around $25 a barrel, for the next decade, understanding that there was going to be an increase in demand from China, emerging markets more generally, but they anticipated that there would be an increasing supply, particularly from the low-cost providers in the Middle East. And really, the rock is what upset that equation, and since then you've seen the price soar. In our book, we take a very conservative approach and say only $5 to $10 of the $75 to $85 increase in the price of oil has to do with the war, but you know, in reality, it's clearly much more than that. So that's one inflationary effect. The second inflationary effect is that because confidence in the United States is eroding so much, confidence in our macro management, confidence more generally, and you see that not only you know in recent polls about where Americans are, but foreigners, the same reaction, money isn't coming in the United States. Money is leaving the United States. People are taking, who held dollars are converting into euros and into other currencies, into yen, and the dollar is declining. Well, that has an inflationary effect. It means that we are going to have to be spending more to buy imported goods. What's kept inflation low for the last decade has been our ability to import cheap goods from China and other emerging markets. But what is going on with the weaker dollar, we're pushing China to appreciate its currency, and that means that we're going to have to pay more and more for the imported goods. So we're paying more for oil, we're paying more for imported goods, and finally, because of the integration of the food and oil markets through biofuels, the high oil prices is now being translated into higher food prices, which are getting to 25-year highs or even more in real terms. So, we are facing an inflationary impact. Many people abroad are very worried that, in fact, this may be a deliberate strategy. Long history of countries around the world when they have large indebtedness, and our national debt has gone up from $6 trillion to $9 trillion in the last 8 years, when they face a high level of indebtedness, one way that you reduce the real value of that indebtedness is through inflation.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that before. That does make a lot of sense, and I could imagine that. Wouldn't that be very encouraging to world financial markets, the sense that's coming as a result?
That's right. No, I mean, I'm not sure that that will happen, but certainly the Federal Reserve is in a pickle now because it's focusing on the most immediate problem, which is the very serious recession, and that means that it's keeping interest rates low, and that in a context where they're facing inflationary pressure. So it does look like we will be facing the highest inflation that we faced in a number of years.
This leads, I think, to the next question, which is linking up, as you said, in the election campaign this year, the war to the economy. Are any of the three remaining major presidential candidates, McCain, Clinton, or Obama, addressing these issues in any way you consider substantive?
Well, I think in a way, both of the Democratic candidates have recognized that we have to leave Iraq. They've recognized the cost of the Iraq war. Obviously, Obama, who was opposed to the war from the very beginning, has been more outspoken on the importance of doing that. But I think now the only candidate not to face up to the reality is Senator McCain. But I want to point out two things about this. First, you know, they don't talk about the cost that we're spending $12 billion a month up front, but by the time you include the downstream cost, the cost of the disabled veterans, the cost of repairing, replacing our equipment, and so forth, you probably double that number. But what they don't point out that is that our military has been very, very badly depleted. And that means just to stay the course, just to keep at the current level, our level of expenditures are almost surely going to go up. They've gone up from $4 billion a month at the beginning of the war to $12 billion a month now, and we can just see that progression continuing. So when you say stay the course, you're also saying increase the expenditures. And then you have to say where we're going to get the money from and who's going to give up what, what's it going to do to the economy. The second point is that they keep saying, you know, security is priceless. But the question is, are we actually getting the most security for the dollars we're spending? And I think security experts are very clear that we're not. We're not even able to secure this one small part of the world. You know, look at a globe of the whole world, a map of the whole world. Iraq is very small. And while we're putting our finger in the dike and not doing it very well, problems are popping up all over the place. Afghanistan is going badly. Pakistan is not doing well. So even if you look at it from a strategic point of view, it's a failed strategy.
Not to mention, as you pointed out, there's a fairly strong argument that all this money has made the situation worse, not better, that it has had no positive effect in terms of security.
That's right. I mean, one way of, you know, focusing on this is to remember, in 2003, al-Qaeda was not in Iraq. It was in Afghanistan, but it was not in Iraq. Now, we've had a problem with al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that just goes to show that if you don't have the right strategic policy, you can actually make things worse and spend a lot of money.
Before we go back to the phone lines for our guest, Joseph Stiglitz, the co-author of The $3 Trillion War, one of the issues we've talked about a little bit, or quite a bit so far, but not enough, and that you write about at some length in the book, is the question of the actual accounting of the number of deaths and injuries as a result of the war. This is an issue, I think, I must say, where I think our news media have been negligent, to put it mildly. You pointed out something that I'd heard, but I wasn't quite certain of, and you've talked about it, that only soldiers who actually die more or less in the line of fire count as war deaths. So the 4,000 soldiers are really understate the actual number of deaths and injuries?
No, no. The deaths include both the combat and the non-combat. It's the injuries where they're distorting. And, of course, the injuries, which are the things that lead to our long-term costs, you know, the cost of the veterans in World War II didn't peak until 48 years after the end of hostilities.
But the deaths don't include the contractor deaths, do they?
Oh, the deaths do not include the contractors, and that's actually a very important point. I was talking before about how they've tried to keep the apparent cost down. So they didn't want to increase the size of the military, which would have made much more visible our presence. If they said we don't have 150,000 troops, we have 250 or 300,000 troops, people would have woken up and said, "What are we doing?" But what they did is put the same number in surreptitiously through contractors. But doing it surreptitiously cost a lot of money. The contractors doing exactly the same thing cost twice or more. You know, take the security contractors. We have some numbers there where the numbers of what a security contractor costs are very, very literally unbelievable, but more than twice of what having somebody in the military provide the same security services. But because they're providing the same services, they're faced death. And over 1,000 of them have been killed. Now, if we had had those services provided by the Department of Defense, the number of military deaths would have been not 4,000, but 5,000 or even more.
You know, one of my friends in Urbana, her brother is an officer, is an Army doctor who works at Walter Reed as a surgeon working on soldiers from Iraq who were flown in. They're sped in from Germany. And he told me, this is a year or two ago, something that your book sort of discusses that I didn't fully appreciate, which is in the effort to keep the death count down, they're keeping alive literally thousands and thousands of people who in any other war would have died, and people whose lives in the future are not going to be very positive considering they're missing large parts of their bodies. And he said it's extraordinary the degree to which they're saving people. And you pointed out in the book that the injury to death rate, that ratio, is significantly higher in this war, meaning they're more injured per dead than in any other war in history.
That's right. I mean, it's phenomenally larger. It's 15-1 as opposed to 2.5-1.
It's just amazing. Because what that means is, in terms of the real casualties, if we want to understand it compared to Vietnam, we'd have to be thinking of much larger numbers to get a sense of the human toll.
That's right, it's not just the lives of these particular individuals, but their whole families, parents, children, wives, siblings. In one out of the five of these families where there is somebody seriously injured, somebody has to give up a job to take care of them, full time. So these are really very serious problems. I was just talking to somebody doing a documentary on it, and down in the works, and multiple amputees, really very hard to believe the magnitude, and unfortunately not shown, not covered as much in the media as it should be.
And then finally, on this question of deaths that I think I want to talk about before we go back to the phone lines, is the whole question of Iraqi deaths, which you talk about. I recall when the Johns Hopkins study came out, one of them a couple of years ago, that estimated the death total of Iraqi civilians at roughly 600,000. President Bush was asked about it, and he said that he didn't think the methodology was very solid by his standards. And that issue is therefore dropped, never discussed again. And even now, when death tolls are given for Iraqi civilians, which they almost never are in our news media, the Department of Defense figures given, which I believe is still 80 or 90,000, but it's under 100,000. What is your, which is striking considering this is a war allegedly about concern about the Iraqi people. What is your take on the actual death toll from your research?
Well, we discussed this issue and discussed some more modern, more recent studies. The Johns Hopkins study was published in The Lancet, which is the leading British medical journal, and there's a more recent study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the leading American journals. First, the important point to realize, we were trying to win the hearts and minds of the people in Iraq. The way we've conducted the war, we've lost that battle. We've lost it pretty badly. Now, the way the Johns Hopkins study was done, as well as the later study that was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, is a standard epidemiological approach. What you do is you look at a sample of villages, they call it a stratified, randomized sample, just like a opinion poll. You can poll 1,000 people and get a pretty good estimate of the total vote pattern of how many are going to vote for one candidate or another. And it's based on that same thing. You get a large enough sample and you do it well enough, you can get a pretty good estimate. And what they did is they compared the death rate before and after 2003. Now, I want to make clear, not all of those are violent deaths, and that's one of the reasons why there's the difference in the numbers. The 100,000 you often hear from the Department of Defense are the violent deaths, and that's an undercount. What they did was to look very carefully at the number of people who died, recognizing that you can't always tell what is a violent death. If you get shrapnel, but it gets infected, and you die a couple weeks later, is that a violent death or is that a consequence of violence? It may not show up in the violent death because it wasn't at that moment. One of the tragic points of the Iraq War has been how it's devastated the middle class. And part of devastating the middle class is that the number of doctors is now one half of what it was in 2003. And that means if you have a problem, if you have shrapnel, if you have some other difficulties, the likelihood that you're going to get medical care is much reduced. But because you don't have electricity, it's often hard to get the medicines that might require refrigeration. So, and because the whole transportation network is interrupted, you may not be able to go to the doctor. The hospital's been destroyed, so you can't go to the hospital. So what they showed is the $600,000, which was only through June 2006, is the number of excess deaths, the increase in the number of deaths over what would have happened had the death rate pre-2003 continued. Now, what we have to remember is that 2007 was the bloodiest year of the war, and if you just continued at the rate through June 2006 till today, we're talking about a number of 900,000, close to a million. So there's absolutely no doubt that this is the this range is the best estimate. There was another study, the one I mentioned in New England Journal of Medicine, that came up with a slightly smaller number, about 3/4 of that number. But it did say that the number of those that were violent were only a fraction of that. But again, as I say, I want to emphasize that it is often difficult to differentiate what are the direct violent, the indirect violent. And so you really have to say what has been the cost of the war in total.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Joseph Stiglitz, the co-author with Linda Bilmes of the brand new book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, just published, just out now with Norton Books, available at fine bookstores and online, I trust, everywhere. We have some callers who've been waiting very patiently to get on the air. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Joe Stiglitz.
Yes, very elucidating. Thank you so much. I wanted to return to something that you were talking about moments ago about the contractor situation. It was the Cheney was SecDef at the end of Bush 1 and instituted this so-called reform that would allow, you know, war profiteering to go into the regular operations of the Army as opposed to just supplying things. The implications of that, you know, we have these examples of larcenous profits by Blackwater and others, KBR and all that. But on the other hand, I think you're sensitive to the issue of the other factor, the non-mercenary, more of the support part of the regular Army in the past. But the Nepalese worker that you said had no multiplier effect. There's occasionally a story about this. The Chicago Tribune got a Pulitzer, I believe, for an expose about how some Nepalese workers were actually sort of almost kidnapped because they're told they're going to Dubai and they end up in Baghdad, and they have to surrender their passports. They can't leave, so they're tantam. And there's, you know, the story of the embassy being built by tantamount to slave labor. They're saving a lot of money on that end of things. So I wonder whether anybody can sort out what the true implications. I mean, there are people that say that the war couldn't have gone ahead without this so-called reform. I was wondering if you could sort it out. I really worry about people investigating this, too. Prathap Chatterjee of CorpWatch, who I think, Bob, you've had on, he's on the ground in Iraq right now trying to investigate this more mundane aspect of the of the war. I'll turn it off there and let you listen to your answer. Thank you.
This is a very serious problem that you've identified. Just yesterday, I was talking to the Philippine commissioner who is concerned with migrants, workers who are leaving Philippines, and they've he was scandalized by the fact that they did not want the people leave the Filipinos work in Iraq because of these exploitation stories, and so they stamp on their passport not valid for Iraq. But what they discovered is that there are 7,000 Filipinos working in Iraq. They go through to get into Iraq. They have to go through our official. We're looking at their papers, so we are deliberately violating Filipino law, we're violating international law, we're violating, you know, basic, we're promoting illegality in order to go up, and we're deliberately, I would say it's not turning an eye, we're actually, our government is an active participant in it, and he was describing, you know, how they go through these checkpoints, and where our soldiers, our government is monitoring what's going on. Of course, they're outraged at this. And the Filipino people are outraged because some of them may be killed, some of them may be captured, they may wind up as hostage. It's obviously not winning us any friends in large parts of the world. Now, that's just one example of how we put money before principle in this war over and over again. Let me give you another example that was uncovered. Halliburton, is the biggest contractor, and much of what they do goes through a subsidiary in Cayman Islands, one of the other offshore islands. Why are they doing it? In order to avoid Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes. In other words, and the military knows this, the Department of Defense knows this, they're encouraging behavior that, if not explicitly illegal, is not the kind of thing that we want to encourage. We don't want people to move offshore to avoid taxes. In fact, we should have a law that says anybody who has a government contract can't do it through an offshore basis. They knew about it, but they were trying, even though it was costing us on another budget, it's costing us on our Social Security budget, we'll have a bigger hole in our Social Security budget because they're not paying it. We'll have a bigger hole in our Medicare budget, which the president keeps talking about, because of this. But they were trying to keep down the deliberate cost, the upfront cost of the Iraq War.
Professor Stiglitz, as I read the section of your book going through the contractors with their cost-plus contracts, Blackwater and Halliburton and the like, I couldn't help but think of President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's famous statement just as we entered World War II, saying the one thing he wanted for certain was to see that there were no new millionaires made as a result of the war, that this tragedy shouldn't create great wealth in the United States. And it seems like that policy doesn't really apply anymore.
That's right. I mean, we look there at what's happened to the stock price. Halliburton has gone up almost threefold. You know, what that means is there are a lot of profits. And, of course, that's what you get in a cost-plus contract. What's interesting, you know, they talk about markets and market mechanisms, but what makes markets work is competition. And if you have sole source contracting, if you you don't have competition, if you have cost-plus contracts, you don't have incentives to economize, you have incentives to spend more. Now, they should have understood that and said, well, we better have more monitoring. But what did they do? They cut back on monitoring. So they were really complicitous in this profiteering that was going on.
And it's still going on, we should add.
It's still going on. But one of the other points that we make that I think has not been made as much as it should have is that not only is it costing us a lot, but these contractors actually are undermining, in a very fundamental way, much of our mission in Iraq. You know, I keep coming back to this thing of how important it was to win the hearts and minds of the people in Iraq. At the beginning of the war, unemployment soared to 60%. And everybody knows that unemployed young men with arms is an explosive mixture, and in Iraq, that explosive mixture exploded. Well, one of the reasons that things got so tense was we were hiring Nepalese, Filipino contractors to work in Iraq when 60%, there were these 60% unemployment rates, where there were so many young men begging for jobs, starving because they didn't have any income. Why? Well, the perspective of the contractors was not what would be best for winning the mission, which was creating jobs for Iraqis. It was, how do I minimize my cost, maximize my profits more so my share price goes up? That's what they were focusing on, not on what was good for America.
Let's go back to the phones right now for Professor Joe Stiglitz, the co-author of the $3 trillion War. Line 2, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air. Hello, line 2. I think line two has lost their patience. Let's try another line now if we can. Line four, Mattoon, you're on the air with Professor Joseph Stiglitz.
I just wondered if you might comment on the idea that this vast debt that we are accumulating and huge amounts that the government isn't getting by cutting taxes for the rich and that it might be an idea to do away with some entitlements or change entitlements form, like Social Security privatization or cutting Medicare, privatizing it because of this huge debt that we've encountered. I'll hang up. Thanks for your comments.
Well, one of the very disappointing parts of what's happened in the last 8 years is that when the tax cuts were made in 2001, people like Alan Greenspan said, oh, we can afford the tax cuts without cuts in future cuts in Social Security of the kind that you described, that the problem was surpluses. You know, as far as the eye could see, he actually said there might be a problem with conducting monetary policy because the national debt would be totally repaid. You know, that kind of hyper-selling of the tax cuts in 2001 and 2003 obviously was wrong. You know, we are now, the national debt has gone up 50% in 8 years, and a significant part of that is due to the war, but a significant part was just due to overspending and to these very expensive tax cuts. Well, I think the first priority is reversing the tax cuts for upper-income Americans. I think the fact is that these people, upper-income Americans, have done very, very well in the last quarter century. Globalization has really benefited them enormously. The average American today, the median American, as we say, 50% above, 50% below, actually has seen their income go down for the last 8 years. This is the first time we've had a recession where, as we go into a recession, incomes of the average American have not recovered from the previous recession. So I don't think this is the time to start talking about cutbacks on Social Security and Medicare for the average American that's already been very hard hit. I think I would put the focus on trying to increase the productivity of America, put the focus on undoing some of the clearly badly designed tax cuts for upper-income Americans that we had in 2001 and 2003. And finally, I think we need to think about the Iraq War, which is so costly, and more broadly, how can we get more security by spending less money, which I think we can.
Professor Stiglitz, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they're going to want to get me out of the studio. I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media
pleasure.
Matters. Professor Joseph Stiglitz, author, co-author of the brand new book, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. My name's Bob McChesney. I would like to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for arranging today's show. We'll be back next week with Norman Solomon, author of Made Love, Got War. And 2 weeks from today, Patrick Coburn, one of the leading Iraq war correspondents, reporting from the scene of what today's discussion's been about. My name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all for joining us. See you in 167 hours.